The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Another beautiful day here on the Ed Stone campus. We're off and running into the summer months now that school is out. Lots of work to be done outside and inside over the course of what will assuredly be a busy summer. We're coming up quick on the June 10th exhibit, the premiere, the reception in Edmond and also in Jerusalem. And just in watching the festivities yesterday on television coming from Jerusalem with the embassy move, the American embassy moving over to Jerusalem or beginning the process yesterday, it did make me think about the receptions that we have scheduled in just a few weeks, a little over 3 weeks, and we'll be kicking off that world premiere of the Isaiah and King Hezekiah bulle. Discovered. So we're excited about that, and plans for that are in motion. There's still lots to do, but a lot that already has happened. Coming up on today's show, if we did have some news pile up at the last minute, so hopefully we'll have some time, though, at the end for a Bible study on the subject of prayer. We've been talking, as some of you know, over the past week, we've been talking a lot about putting our heart into God's work. And of course, whether you're a full-fledged member of the Church of God, or if you're a co-worker supporting the work with your tithes and offerings, or a donor, or just a viewer, a reader of the Trumpet magazine, to be sure, one way that you can really contribute a lot to God's work is with your offerings, your spiritual offerings, those prayers that we offer to God every day. Also, coming up on today's show, I want to look at the transatlantic relationship. There's been just so much happening with the United States regarding the Iran nuclear deal, and then more recently, of course, as we discussed yesterday, the embassy move and quite a resurgence for the United States and to some degree for the Israeli state as well. But another huge, huge dimension to this story, or all that's happening, particularly with the termination of the Iran nuclear deal, is how that this is impacting America's relationship with Europe. I mean, there are a lot of leaders in Europe who are up in arms, and not just because of the Iran nuke deal, what the president decided with that, but with the Paris Accords, and of course, the embassy move and this strong relationship that's forming between the United States and Israel. But there are a lot of diplomats, a lot of presidents, a lot of high-ranking officials in Europe that are pretty much saying this is the end of the transatlantic relationship. Richard Palmer helped me put together some material for that segment coming up later in this first half of the program. So stick around for that so that we can really bring you right up to date with the significance of these developments from a prophetic standpoint, as always. Well, just continuing on with the historic day yesterday in Jerusalem. Again, we touched on this at the start of yesterday's show. If you haven't listened to that one, there's quite a few that have listened, I noticed this morning on the SoundCloud figures. But if you haven't listened to that, you can, of course, get to that program and all of our podcasts at thetrumpet.com website. But on yesterday's show, we talked about this U.S. delegation, and in just looking at some of the footage yesterday, I mean, what a delegation this was. You had the president of the United States, you had his daughter there, his son-in-law made a statement, Jared Kushner. There are, I think, four senators in attendance, and then quite a number of congressmen as well, maybe eight or ten of them. And then all pretty much anyone who's anyone in Israel was there. Prime Minister Netanyahu, President Rivlin, lots of other representatives, ambassadors, former ambassadors, quite a collection of high-ranking officials from Israel and the United States. There, I believe it was just south of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Here's a bit from what Prime Minister Netanyahu had to say at the ceremony. Clip one.
We gather here today to celebrate another historic day in the life of this city, which I know will take its place alongside other momentous decisions in the history of our people. Over a century ago, the Balfour Declaration recognized the right of the Jewish people to a national home in this land. And exactly 70 years ago today, President Truman became the first world leader to recognize the newborn Jewish state. Last December, President Trump became the first world leader to recognize Jerusalem as our capital. And today, the United States of America is opening its embassy right here in Jerusalem. Thank you. Thank you, President Trump, for having the courage to keep your promises. Thank you, President Trump, and thank you all for making the alliance between America and Israel stronger than ever.
So quite a resurgence we're seeing here from the United States, and together with it, Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu, they're talking about this special alliance and this historic day. Finally, the United States taking the lead, and others are now following, as I said on yesterday's program. So quite a celebration. President Trump himself, although he wasn't there, he had a prepared statement that was played on video, and he was watching it on television, evidently, judging by his tweets. So he was very excited, and it got quite a lot of coverage, but of course, all of the coverage was juxtaposed with the Gaza border clash. That was given equal time. The violence there at the border, Gaza's border with Israel, had it been any other border clash in the world, and there's lots of them, it would have been a non-story. But because it was Hamas in Gaza, and because the clash was with Israelis or Jews, everyone in the world weighed in. Even leaders, as we'll see in a moment, who've massacred hundreds of people at their own borders. But they're given a pass. Not Israel. Not to minimize the violence that did happen there. 58, I believe, were killed and something like 1,700 injured. But 40,000 Palestinians took part in this. It wasn't just a demonstration. It was a violent riot. Meeting at 13 different locations along the fence, along the border with Israel, with Molotov cocktails or other explosive devices, throwing stones, burning kites and sending them over the border and in the hope that it would burn down some of the Israeli farms. This is from the New York Post. It says, Monday's opening of the American Embassy in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, righted a historic wrong, as both American and Israeli speakers noted. The custom throughout the world, and throughout the ages, is for foreign embassies to be located in the city designated by the host country as its capital. This is something several speakers pointed out yesterday. These visiting nations, they put their embassies in the city where the host country says it's the capital, except for Israel. Israel's the one exception. Until now, anyway. It says, and so now the rest of the world is out of step when it comes to Israel, and only Israel. That would be a curious exception if the pattern weren't so pronounced and the reason so obvious. It says the world's double standard against the Jewish state helps explain the decision by Hamas leaders in Gaza to mix armed terrorists and unarmed civilians and urge them to crash through the border fence. This was murder. And not by Israeli soldiers defending their country against a mass invasion. The blood of the dead and wounded is on the hands of the merciless Hamas thugs who sent their people on a suicide mission that had zero chance of military success. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, tweeted out the fact that Hamas had put many women in the front of these protests, in the front of this riot, women, human shields. It says here in the Post, but of course, military success was not the goal. The goal was to get the headlines and pictures the world is seeing. The bloodier, the better. So when the New York Times writes that Israel kills dozens and wounds 1,700 at Gaza border, it's mission accomplished for Hamas. There was another mainstream headline that said Israel kills 58 in Gaza, as if Israel penetrated Gaza's borders and started shooting people indiscriminately. It was the other way around. It was Hamas, together with the women, I guess, puncturing holes in the Israeli fence and storming Israel. Fully prepared to sacrifice their own women and children so that they could grab headlines. For them, that's the victory. Mission accomplished. Mission accomplished. I mean, the Jerusalem Post had a lengthy expose on just the past 6 weeks. Of course, today it culminates in Nakba Day or Catastrophe Day. We touched on this yesterday as well. But how that they gathered, one report, as I read a moment ago, said there were 13 locations. The Post says that for the past 6 weeks, you know, these protests have been ongoing. There have been five main locations right along Israel's security fence. 8 weeks, I guess, the demonstrations have gone on. And they, as I said, they'll light kites on fire and send them across the border. They'll burn tires, massive fires, in the hope that it will spread. But these protesters, as they're called, they're just called protesters, but that isn't even the right way to label them. They gather something like 40,000 yesterday, but they gather in these camps, these tents, a couple hundred meters from the fence. And Hamas sets up field hospitals, prayer areas, play areas for the families. There's people there selling food. And then in the morning, it's all carefully coordinated and organized by Hamas officials. They'll show up early in the morning and stir people to act and stir people to protest, quote unquote. Including, as the IDF said, even the women and the children. And they go off toward the border fence, knowing there's a distinct possibility that they're going to get shot. Most of them are shot in the leg because that's where the IDF aims. Or some body limb as opposed to, you know, something that would be more fatal. But inevitably, there's going to be fatalities when you've got hundreds of people storming your border. Well, Hamas has the ambulance teams ready, the medics ready. They're all prepared and ready because, again, the objective here is to get headlines. The objective here is to get the images, the pictures, the video of these suffering, bloodied Hamas members. That's what it amounts to. Or the human shields. The objective for many of them, and they don't always get to that point because Israel has a right to defend itself. But there's a Hamas operative in the cluster with wire cutters there to cut through the fence. So what is Israel supposed to do? Just stand down and let them stream in? I mean, the terrorists among them, they're hoping to capture an Israeli soldier. so that they can murder a soldier or hold a soldier captive. This is what's going on there at the border, carefully planned by Hamas, carefully coordinated on the Palestinian side. Hamas members, some of them unarmed, some of them armed, directing the crowds, causing the mayhem. And then, of course, if Israel responds, well, I mean, you see the reaction. The Jerusalem Post says here, planning began ahead of the March 14th protest. That would be yesterday. Planning began on the 10th. It says Joe Dyke, the AFP correspondent in Gaza, wrote on May 10th that at a briefing to foreign media, Gaza head of Hamas told journalists today he would support thousands of Palestinians breaking through the border fence next week. They told the media, they told the international media, look, what we're going to do is we're going to break through the border fence. We're going to attack Israel. We're willing to sacrifice some of our own because we know that you members of the media, you're going to give us some good coverage. It says on Sunday, the IDF dropped leaflets on Gaza, warning protesters to stay away from the fence. On May 14th, Dyke, that's Joe Dyke, the AFP rep, he tweeted, literally as the U.S. Embassy inauguration is beginning, loudspeakers east of Gaza City are calling on protesters to prepare to seek to breach the border fence. That's a tweet coming from AFP. It was coordinated. It was meant to happen right as the U.S. Embassy inauguration party or festival or reception began. They stormed the border fence, 40,000 of them, and the objective was to seek to breach the fence, to puncture a hole, to move on through. And then the reaction from the world, of course, is always predictable. But now, as we've been discussing, I mean, there's a different direction. There's a new direction in the United States of America. And America's response to these kinds of atrocities is quite a bit different than it would have been 2, 3, 4 years ago. Here's what the White House spokesman, Raj Shah, said yesterday, talking about the violence in Gaza, clip 4.
The responsibility for these tragic deaths rests squarely with Hamas. Hamas is intentionally and cynically provoking this response. And as the Secretary of State said, Israel has the right to defend itself.
Pretty emphatic coming from the White House spokesman. It's not that both sides need to, you know, tamp down the violence or to reduce the hostilities. That's what we've been used to hearing. Well, look, we're calling on both sides. We're calling on both sides to de-escalate this situation. That's the White House now saying that the responsibility rests squarely with Hamas. Pretty amazing. Later on in the same press conference, a reporter pressed the representative with this, clip 5.
Peter. If I can very quickly, the French Foreign Minister Raj said about what's taking place in Gaza. He urged Israeli authorities to exercise discretion and restraint. So to be clear, does the U.S. not agree with the French that Israeli authorities should exercise discretion and restraint?
We believe that Hamas is responsible for what's going on.
So there's no responsibility beyond that on the Israeli authorities. Kill at will.
What I'm saying is that we believe that Hamas, as an organization, is engaged in cynical action that's leading to these deaths.
Good for him to speak the truth. You don't hear much of it today. We go through Isaiah 59 quite often on this program, where it says, none calls for justice, nor any pleads for truth. That's God's assessment. Nobody's pleading for truth anymore. It's just all based on vanity and lies. I mean, the way that reporter sees it, Israel is just killing at will. Israel is just killing at will. Never mind the truth. Even when you've got an AFP reporter embedded in the Gaza location, he's hearing it direct from Hamas. We're sending thousands to the border on Monday. And we're preparing to seek to breach the border fence. And then he's there on hand, this AFP reporter, saying, I mean, as soon as the embassy inauguration began, the call went out on loudspeakers. Let's get our protesters, let's get our women and children to that border fence. Well, you don't hear much of it, but it's refreshing when you do hear, when you do actually hear someone telling the truth. Benjamin Netanyahu even touched on this, citing a scripture from Zechariah in his statement yesterday at the inauguration celebration. Here's clip two.
The prophet Zechariah declared over 2,500 years ago, Koh amar Adonai, Shavti el Tzion, v'shachanti betoch Yerushalayim, v'nikre'a Yerushalayim ir ha'emet. So said the Lord, I will return to Zion, and I will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem shall be called the city of truth. May the opening of this embassy in this city spread the truth far and wide, and may the truth advance a lasting peace between Israel and all our neighbors. God bless the United States of America, and God bless Jerusalem, the eternal, undivided capital of Israel.
That's Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday at the U.S. Embassy inauguration there in Jerusalem, quoting from Zechariah chapter 8, where it says, Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth. Of course, that passage is millennial, and there's not many world leaders that understand much about the soon coming kingdom of God to be set up on this earth, headquartered at Jerusalem. But this was the gospel message that Jesus proclaimed. Zechariah 8, verse 2, it says, Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury. Thus says the Eternal, verse 3, I am returned unto Zion, and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth. And the mountain of the Eternal of Hosts, the holy mountain. I mean, the very name Jerusalem means city of peace. That's the city that's coming to this earth. A city of peace, a city of truth, a city that God has chosen. A city God has chosen to be the world capital. God's headquarters city. It's hard not to get swept up into the enthusiasm, the excitement, the energy that you saw there in that celebration. To just think about when Jesus Christ will return to this earth and establish God's government, God's perfect government. And of course, at that point, there's not going to be all of these endless disputes and this stream of lies that are broadcast all over the earth. Well, there's plenty of resistance that God and his family are going to face up front, right at the return of Christ. But then after that, 1,000 years of peace, 1,000 years of what's described in Zechariah 8. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, verse 4, There shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, and every man with his staff in his hand for very age. It says, And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof. That's the way life will be in the wonderful world of tomorrow. That's the way life will be in the cities of tomorrow. That doesn't happen in Jerusalem today. It certainly doesn't happen around Gaza. The boys and girls there, well, if they're unlucky, they get thrust to the front of the mob that streams for the border fence, to breach the border fence so that they can grab the headlines. And then supporters in the media, they'll take that message and run with it and then tell you that Israel, the Israeli authorities, are killing at will. When we come back, we'll get into this other angle, as I say, this relationship between the United States and Europe, the transatlantic relationship. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Last week, President Trump acknowledged another truth and kept another promise. He announced his intention to exit the dangerous, flawed and one-sided Iran deal. Iran's aggression threatens the many peace-loving citizens throughout the region and the entire world, from Israel to Jordan to Egypt to Saudi Arabia and beyond.
That's Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, yesterday at the U.S. Embassy inauguration in Jerusalem, acknowledging or talking about another truth. Another truth that you don't hear much of today. President Trump himself tweeted on Sunday. He said, remember how badly Iran was behaving with the Iran deal in place? They were taking over the Middle East by whatever means necessary. This is how they were behaving when the deal was in place. There was a story just this morning in the Telegraph about Muqtada al-Sadr, remember him? The firebrand cleric, as he's called by the Telegraph. He led a militia that fought against American troops in Iraq. British troops in Iraq. He's responsible for killing who knows how many Sunnis, but who knows how many Americans and Brits? Well, now he's taken a shocking lead in the Iraqi election. Here he is now. He's reformed. He's a politician now. Right there in Iraq, all that blood that was spilled over the course of many, many years, 10 years plus. And here he shows up, and this is who the Iraqi people want in there, evidently. Now, he may not get the most strong coalition put together if he does, in fact, win. I think 40% of the count is in thus far. But still, just look at some recent history. We had an article on him in 2016, 2 years ago. Callum Wood, he wrote a piece talking about the early part of this century. This Sodder character, a violent extremist, as Callum put it. He had his Mahdi army, this 50,000-strong militia, murdering Sunnis right and left. Those left over from Saddam's regime. This civil war, as we know, was raging for years between Sunni and Shia. But as Callum brings out here in his piece, Sadr's army also targeted United States forces, claiming to have used at least 6,000 improvised explosive devices. That's IEDs, 6,000 of them. The U.S. put out an arrest warrant for Sadr, who, not surprisingly, fled to Iran for sanctuary. They wanted to arrest him, the U.S. forces. And now he could become the political leader of Iraq. He had to seek refuge in Iran, of all places. Surprise, surprise. Look at what President Trump tweeted yesterday, as I said. Look at the way they were behaving when the deal was in place. Well, U.S. forces left Iraq in 2011. Sadr comes back, and now he's a leading politician. This bloodthirsty terrorist. He's saying all the right things. Callum says Sadr has mastered the art of policy switching. In 2014, he dissolved his political party, renamed his private army, and promised to leave politics. Basically, Sadr supported Maliki, then he didn't. Then he supported Iran, then he couldn't. He was a radical hardliner, then he wasn't. He promised to leave politics, then he wouldn't. Now he supports Abadi. I mean, this is from 2016, this piece. We could add to that list that now he's the front runner. Now he takes a shocking lead in the Iraqi elections. Callum, in that piece from 2 years ago, he said, there is little wonder why many call Sadr the most dangerous man in Iraq. And then he talks about all of his flip-flops. But then notice this concluding paragraph. Regardless of what he says or who he allegedly supports, Sadr's religious beliefs define him. He may change his political colors every other week. He may change his public image to boost his popularity. But his Shiite upbringing leads to an inevitable conclusion at the end of the day. Sadr must support Iran. At the end of the day, this radical cleric, this Shiite Muslim, this Iranian stooge, you could say, he might well be the leader of Iraq. Well, if you've been following us for very long, you know all about what we've been saying since the early 1990s. About Iraq swinging into the Iranian camp. I mean, what more evidence do we need? Truth. Since it's important to speak the truth. Here's another truth. This is just recent history. Recent history about this terrorist. Look at how Iran was behaving, even when the deal was in place. Melanie Phillips, she wrote earlier today, the result of the West's appeasement of Iran has been regional chaos, world terror, and 120,000 missiles embedded among the civilian population in Lebanon. From where they're pointing at Israel. That's over in Lebanon. And then they had all these installations, at least until last week, in southern Syria. Missiles aimed into the Golan Heights. And then they're the ones providing the funding to Hamas. Hamas, if they can't get people to go out because they want to be a martyr, then they pay them. They pay them off. And that money's coming from Iran. so that those martyrs can capture the headlines, martyrs the way Hamas views it. And then the international media, they just take it and run with it. Israel killing at will, Israel killing at will, Israel killing at will. That's what we want you to know. Truth. Truth. There's so little of it today. So it is refreshing when you hear it from an administration in the White House, particularly when you're not accustomed to hearing it. Still, though, the reaction for so many, including European leaders, the EU coming out yesterday again, taking the position of Israel not using disproportional force. So if they burn kites, if they burn tires, if they have wire cutters, if they come across with knives or clubs or slingshots, then you can't shoot them. I guess you have to hit them back with slingshots. The EU's calling for Israel to tamp it down. France probably came out the strongest. Well, at least among Western nations, there were those like Mahmoud Abbas who accused Israel of carrying out a massacre. And then Turkey, of all nations, to come out and call it a massacre. Erdogan said it was a genocide. This is the same Erdogan that turned his border security loose on refugees. He just mowed down hundreds of them in January, 5 months ago. These were people fleeing the violence in Syria. These were not people coming up to the Turkish border with wire cutters, trying to kidnap a Turkish military guy. These were individuals running for their lives, and they were being mowed down by Turkish forces. Didn't hear much about that. No international outcry. No strongly worded UN resolutions. And then this dictator has the gall to get up and say Israel's guilty of genocide. Well, as I say, one development from all of this that we want to keep a close eye on is how that this impacts the relationship between the United States and Europe, this transatlantic alliance. Foreign Policy had a piece a couple days ago, Rest in Peace, the Transatlantic Alliance. And then it gives the dates, 1945 to 2018. I mean, this is the end. The alliance was already a corpse, as Foreign Policy says. But, I mean, Donald Trump, he's driven the last nail into its coffin. This is it. It's over. That last nail, according to Foreign Policy, was the nuclear deal with Iran, terminating that deal. I mean, this has a lot of leaders in Europe upset. Not just this. As I said, the climate change accords, the president is threatening to impose sanctions on European aluminum and steel. But listen, the trumpet has a really unique position on these developments. Almost everyone's talking about this split, or those who are, I should say. They come from one or the other side. One side says, hey, the Iran deal is great, and President Trump was a fool to leave it. On the other hand, there would be those who support Donald Trump and say they don't trust the Iranians. But they're not really talking about Europe's reaction, or they don't care. They figure, well, the Trump administration can go it alone. Who cares what Europe thinks? You listen to this program, and I mean, you get some truth. And you hear about just how terrible the Iran deal was and is. And President Trump was right to stand up to them and to put an end to it. But here's where the message is unique. Europe's response, it is important. It is something we want to keep our eye on. My father wrote back in 2014, this was during the spying scandal, the Obama administration spying on European allies. The press didn't seem too concerned about that. They're quite happy when it's Obama spying on Europe, spying on Israel, spying on Trump. My father wrote in 2014, most Americans don't realize how violently our allies are condemning our foreign policy. They're too absorbed and distracted with sports, entertainment, and domestic issues to be interested. But this is something everyone should be concerned about. What makes the German-American split especially important is this. It is exactly what biblical prophecy told us would happen. I mean, for the longest time, we've just been so used to this relationship between lovers. But the Bible talks about a double cross, a betrayal. And so we're seeing some serious signs of this split, this divorce. Foreign Policy says the Iran decision has resonated among European leaders as none of Trump's previous follies has. And again, it's wrong to call it a folly. The folly was ever getting into the deal in the first place. But what's true about that statement is that this decision, President Trump's decision, has really shaken the European continent. There's one, I think he's the former Prime Minister of Sweden. He wrote a column recently at the Washington Post, and he called President Trump's decision to blow up the Iran deal as a massive attack on Europe. He sees it as an attack. Here are these European nations. They're more inclined to stick up for and to defend the mullahs in Iran than they are the current administration in Washington, the Trump administration in Washington. This former Swedish prime minister, he said it would be most unwise to underestimate the long-term damage to the transatlantic relationship caused by Washington's assault on Europe. Strong voices are now demanding that Europe stand up for its sovereignty by being more confrontational with Trump. That's what he wants. That's what Spiegel wants. The popular German weekly. The weekly publication. It's time for Europe to join the resistance against Trump, they mean. Europe needs to resist America. This is Spiegel, a column in Spiegel recently. The West, as we once knew it, no longer exists. I mean, everything has changed. Our relationship with the U.S. cannot currently be called a friendship, Spiegel says. It can't even hardly be referred to as a partnership. Further on, it says it's now about whether transatlantic cooperation on economic, foreign, and security policy even exists anymore. The answer, no. It's impossible to overstate what Trump has dismantled in the last 16 months. This is the way Europe sees it. This is the way the German ruling class sees it. It's impossible to overstate what President Trump has dismantled in just 16 months. Here again, Spiegel's calling for resistance. Resistance against America. Another article says it's time for Europe to stand up. This article says Europe's facing the potential loss of what has been the most important, most reliable, most beneficial constant of European foreign policy for decades, the partnership with the U.S. and the transatlantic relationship. The U.S. has chosen a path of confrontation with Europe. I mean, they make no bones about it. We're being attacked by Donald Trump. America has chosen the path of confrontation. It talks about and gives some examples to disputes that they've had previously, like with George Bush over the Iraq War, but how that this time, I mean, it's different. It's different. This conflict has the potential to escalate into a real confrontation between Europe and the United States. In a worst-case scenario, Trump could force Europe to make a choice between the U.S. and Iran. Yes, and they're thinking about Iran. Now again, we know what Bible prophecy says is ultimately going to happen. The big clash, I mean the spectacular clash, is coming between Germany and Iran. So they're aiming all of their wrath at the Trump administration for now. But there's going to be some dramatic earth-shaking developments in the next few years? Well, all of this is just going to, in the short run, It's going to bring Europe together. Spiegel says Europe has lost its protective power. It has lost its guarantor of joint values. So there are those sounding the alarm. There are others who are like, it's about time. Everyone sees this. This is a good thing. This is going to bring us together. This is what we've been waiting for. Switching back to that foreign policy piece, listen to this quote. It says, even if cooler heads prevail, Europe may begin laying the foundations for a more independent military and diplomatic strategy. Okay, we've talked about that before. The united military front. Europe's been taking baby steps in that direction for some time. It's just something needs to accelerate it. And of course, we're waiting on the Daniel H. Strongman as well. But it says here, this is foreign policy, all talk of a united European army has long vanished, but Macron, that's the French premier, Macron has invited the defense ministers of 10 European nations to Paris next month to discuss his plan to create a battle-ready force of up to 100,000 troops. As it happens, there's 10 nations that he's bringing to Paris, or representatives, defense ministers from these 10. Of course, we know from Revelation 17 that eventually there's going to be the 10 kings, or the 10 toes, to go with that image in Daniel 2. Foreign policy says, everyone I have spoken to has felt that the split with Trump has given a serious boost to the plan. That's the military, the independent European military plan. And it talks more about Macron riding high. I guess he recently received the Charlemagne Prize. Switching back to Spiegel, it says here, the Europeans have been united in shock, in anger, at President Trump's irresponsible move and in their refusal to accept it. But they are also united in their helplessness when it comes to dealing with this new America. I mean, they need to be stronger. They need to confront. They need stronger leadership. Remember my father's Key of David program from just a week and a half ago. The strong man of Europe. I mentioned yesterday how strong the program was this past weekend. The one on temporarily saving Israel. We'll go back and look at the one before this past weekend. The strong man of Europe, again, very direct, strong message, a strong warning. And, of course, in that program, he talked about just how critical Sue Gutenberg has been toward Merkel. But even as one of these articles brings out, I mean, even Merkel is coming on strong against the United States, against President Trump. It's so easy to do these days in Europe. Merkel said recently, Europe can no longer rely on the U.S. It must take its fate into its own hands. Well, actually, that wasn't even a recent statement. That's something that she said last year. And when she made that statement last year, it caused quite a stir. But now, I mean, statements like that, they're just stated as a matter of fact. It doesn't even surprise anyone. Well, you look at the coming economic confrontation. We've talked to you before about the coming trade war. I mentioned those tariffs that the president is considering. And, of course, he's made other statements saying that if European nations get on board with their dealings with Iran, that they might face sanctions from the United States, too. Where is this leading? Well, you can see. You might have seen that little image on the Drudge Report, I think, a few days ago. It basically showed President Trump as a middle finger to the world. It shows Mr. Trump as making an obscene gesture to the rest of the world. And this follows other infamous covers at Spiegel, showing President Trump as a KKK member, and on it goes. There is no love for Donald Trump in the German media, Zu Gutenberg. There's no love for Donald Trump in his thinking either. And my father has drawn attention to that. He wrote just last year that there's a strong man coming. He's coming on the scene. And he referenced Daniel 11 saying that he's going to come in by flatteries. He's really going to come in knowing how to say the right things. And people are just going to follow along. It's like this now politician, this distinguished politician in Iraq, Muqtada al-Sadr. He says one thing one week, and then the next week it's something different. And lo and behold, he's gaining in popularity. He might win the election. It doesn't matter what he does. It doesn't matter his history, even his recent history. Flattering words. My father said last year, what's amazing is Gutenberg went after American President Donald Trump in a way a world leader never does to another leader in power. He called him the violent madman in the White House. That's the way Zu Gutenberg sees Donald Trump, the madman in the White House. How many other European leaders see Mr. Trump that same way? My father referred to the other speeches and appearances Gutenberg has made over the past year. And then he points out the fact that, well, you know, Donald Trump got more than 60 million votes. And so when he comes out that strong against Donald Trump, when he comes out condemning the president of the United States that way, I mean, what does it say about his attitude toward America? And where is this leading ultimately? Well, it's leading to that double cross in a dramatic way. Look into my father's booklet, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet. Check out chapter 10 from that booklet. It's all prophesied. He writes, listening to Mr. Gutenberg and the way people are responding to him, I have to say that it looks like the relationship between the U.S. and Germany is already dead. This is what my father was writing last year. I think the title is A Turning Point in German Politics. And what was that headline I gave to you, or that Spiegel article that said it was a corpse? But now, I mean, the final nail's in the coffin because of Donald Trump, because of the Iran nuke deal. The trumpet really does give you a unique insight into not only the significance of what's happening right now, but what will happen. He said further, prophecy tells us in detail just what this strong man is going to do. It also says that he can't even imagine the damage he will wreak on America. But at a certain point, his mind is going to change. You can read about that prophecy in Habakkuk. There's going to be a mind change. The prophet Nahum has something to say on that as well. But I mean, you look at the mind, even as it's expressing its thoughts today, verbally. And already it's pretty hostile. It's pretty condemnatory toward the White House. This may be the man, as my father said in that article last year, that we've been watching for. This man that's prophesied. He said, finally, watch Germany. I believe we're seeing more than just dislike for one man in the White House. There's evidence of a desire for revenge. After all, history would have played out very differently if it hadn't been for America's intervention in World Wars I and II. Hitler, he was out for revenge, and Churchill knew it, and Churchill warned about it, and Churchill just spoke the truth when no one else had the courage to do it. They didn't have the courage to tell the truth to the people of Britain. Churchill he knew exactly what Hitler was up to in early 1936 when German forces headed into the Rhineland. He anticipated. He told his wife about it, and he told her also that, well, surely this will be the end of it, because then France and Britain will act. They have to act. And Hitler's generals were terrified because the German army wasn't strong enough to resist against the French. But he knew a little bit of something about the way of the appeaser. And he was willing to take the risk, Hitler was. and France and Britain didn't act. And Germany's power and might grew much, much stronger. Well, we're seeing history about to repeat itself. My father says finally in this piece, you wouldn't think human beings would think that way, but if you understand biblical prophecy, you know that there's an evil spirit being involved who can inspire some very ugly emotions. And the Bible is clear that America's German lovers, quote unquote, are going to betray America. So some pretty significant developments. Some of this content here, I believe Richard's going to be working a fair bit of it up into his trumpet brief for later today. So you can be looking for that in your inbox if you're if you've subscribed to our daily email blast. If you haven't, you can get a subscription to the daily trumpet brief at our website, thetrumpet.com. You can also go to the website to search for that article that I quoted from here at the last, my father's article from last year, A Turning Point in German Politics. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we put the finishing touches on another program. We didn't have that much time left for our Bible study. We'll push it back to tomorrow. But thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.